Hi everyone. Thanks for coming along. We'll kick off with our guest speaker session now. And tonight, as you know, our guest speaker is Still Gehring, and he is going to talk to us, well, rather not so much talk to us, but I guess kick off a discussion on what it means to be a freelancer today, what's happening in the global marketplace with outsourcing, with computer algorithms that are doing the writing for us. We're just going to throw some ideas around between us after that to look at what you can do to survive and thrive in that sort of marketplace. So over to you, Still Gehring.
Thanks, Steve. I'm assuming everyone can hear me because it's a small room. I'll just let you know, I'm recording this for my own reference, and if everyone's happy, I'll also put it on my website. If anyone doesn't want their voice recorded when you ask questions later, just the first time you speak, or published, I should say, just the first time you speak, say, don't publish me before asking your question, and that'll remind me to edit that bit out if you'd rather that not in there. I'm not here to kind of make anyone's life a misery. Just quick background, I've been freelancing now since 1996 or 7 or so. Some of it in the computer IT support, network support world. Since 2007, back to working in the media. I used to be a producer with ABC Radio in the dim dark ages, and I've run a magazine and I've run a radio station, and I survived a startup in the first dot-com boom. Never again. And these days, the stuff I cover, I mean, I work freelance for, well, anyone who'll pay me, but I cover things to do with the internet and how that's changing. So I'm trying not to do the daily news cycle, and I'm fortunate enough to be at the point where I can now do the grumpy old man commentary and really pick and choose a bit. So it's where the internet hits the intersection with politics and the media and how it's changing the world. And I will say a lot of what I do now is about information security. But because I've worked in the media a long time, I'm kind of also writing about how the internet is changing that. I'm trying to kind of bash a few people around the head with some obvious changes that they're not getting. And I will just throw in as an aside, one of the fun things over the next few years is going to be watching the big industrial age media factories struggle to survive. Australia has so far survived that much better than, say, the United States, the UK, Europe, but that can't last forever. And we hear a lot about how the media is dying. And I go, well, it's not actually. People are consuming more media than ever. It's just that the old industrial age media factories are dying, and they're complaining about it, and they're in a position to tell politicians that they're dying, whereas, in fact, there are thousands of small media outlets around the world, and some not so small, thriving, growing rapidly. So that'll be interesting to see how that plays out over the next few years. And speaking of new media operations, I thought I'd kick off with a story. This is a news report. It'd be about baseball because it's an American thing. And I don't know the teams involved, but this story says, Friona fell 10-8 to Boys Ranch in 5 innings on Monday at Friona, despite racking up 7 hits and 8 runs. Friona was led by a flawless day at the dish by Hunter Sundre, who went 2-2 against Boys Ranch pitching. Sundre singled in the 3rd innings and tripled in the 4th. Friona piled up the steals, swiping 8 bags in all, etc., etc. That was written by a computer.
Sounds like it.
And that was the product of a company in Chicago called Narrative Science, who last year wrote 400,000 news reports of things like minor league sports around the United States. Parents of kids playing in these games had an app on their phone and would just punch in the scores that they went. They had the team lists. There's 30 staff in the company at the moment. They worked with professional sports writers to create templates for games to figure out, well, what is the most interesting thing about this game that you would report, to build those algorithms and report those stories. And what's happening now, interestingly, so far, is that there is now reportage of sporting matches at a much lower level than would ever have been possible in the past. Now, there's a question mark over that. Does that mean that this will then go up the chain and then all of the major league sports will eventually just churn this stuff out or not? Will that free up journalists to concentrate on the bigger stuff because they're not dealing with the third round match that, you know, no one's really interested in as much except the fans of that team? Narrative science has also been covering things like stock market stories and business stories. It can read patterns, it can look for keywords in announcements, it can watch LinkedIn to see when an executive moves from one company or resigns and then write a story that matches, well, that executive left, so what did that do to the share price? And again, there's a lot of happy customers. So this is the automation part of it that's happening. And there are kind of some other examples too, and I'll come back to them. The other big challenge is globalization of the marketplace. And it really is the case now that anyone can pitch for work anywhere on the planet. An Australian company, freelancer.com, is actually the world leader in this. And Matt Barry, the CEO, won BRW's Entrepreneur of the Year award the other year, and last year, and he's won a whole bunch of awards for this. He actually bought the company. It started off in Sweden, and he bought it and renamed it to freelancer.com and did the thing. So in a sense, he's that kind of entrepreneur. It wasn't his idea originally, but he worked out, hey, this is actually something really good, and these guys don't realize how good it is. Last year, they clocked up, I think, their 2 millionth project. Now, how it works is, if you have skills, you register on the site. If someone has work to do, they put a description of their project on the site, and you bid for it. And well, some of it goes on obviously price, but the thing is, there's people working globally on this. At the moment, most of the work, because it's online, tends to be things like website development and software development, graphic design, graphic production, and so on. But they have had people do, I mean, all manner of freelance work, bookkeeping, anything that can be done remotely without face-to-face contact. And, you know, they're growing in leaps and bounds. They're not the only player. And they'll tell you a great story of a guy in India who's become exceedingly rich by selling into Western countries $65 websites. And yes, all right, what do you get for that? But that's the idea that many, many small businesses, at least so far, are getting their first website ever. They don't want anything fancy. They don't actually have any complex needs yet. And even if they do, they're quite often available in you know, just by bolting together a few modules online, and you just need to kind of build that for them. This guy's done very, very well. He's based in India. So we have these global marketplaces, and we have automation tools. Now, what I thought I might do is sketch through a couple of the other possibilities in there and then kind of see how it goes, open up for questions and comments. Just some things I have noticed. One is that there is a vast pool of people on this planet who are now just starting to get decent internet access and who are desperate for money. And when I say desperate, that doesn't mean they'll do anything, but they're also coming from an environment where $5 an hour is a princely sum. I've been to villages in East Africa where the monthly income for a family, the monetary income, is about $10 a month. They're starting to get mobile phones in there. And although I didn't see this particular example firsthand, there are actually Maasai herdsmen out in the field with their cattle in northern Tanzania who, while they're just keeping an eye on their cattle, are translating documents from their Swahili into their regional native language. They're SMS'd a sentence in the language, they translate the sentence and SMS it back, and they get paid per sentence that they translate, so they can work at their own pace. The SMS rate in Tanzania is, I think, about a fifth of a cent or something, because SMS is the biggest data transfer scam pricing in the history of the universe. So they, you know, they rip us off here, but for the Africans, they've priced it a lot cheaper. India, interestingly, is now starting to price itself out of the market for things like software development and call centre work, because as they have got more of that work and there are more people with money in Mumbai, say, well, it's driven prices up. So therefore, they've had to put their prices up, and the Western countries are going, oh, hang on, this is more expensive than it used to be. But we just had the East Africa fibre go down the whole East Coast, Tanzania, Kenya and so on. And in Dar es Salaam and in Kenya, well, they were British colonies. They do have an English-speaking, bureaucratically-minded, tertiary-educated core. We can get this done cheaper in Nairobi than in Mumbai now, and that's starting to grow as a centre for outsourcing. And that's the point, that the connectivity is growing, the internet is going everywhere, and there's an awful lot of work that can be done without necessarily having massive amounts of bandwidth. And what organisation doesn't try and reduce its costs? So there's that kind of pressure. There's also the reality that many organisations are happy with good enough quality rather than craftsman-built quality. How many people have a cabinet maker make their furniture these days? I mean, those guys are out there. But who hires their services? A few people, obviously, but not everyone can keep doing this. At an even more fundamental level is Amazon runs a service called Mechanical Turk. Who has not heard of that? Okay, quite a few. Yep. Mechanical Turk. The name comes from I forget which particular. I think it was a Turkish sultan who would fool visiting people, because he would have this mechanical, it was called the Mechanical Turk, but it was supposedly a robot that would play chess, and it would always win, and it would astound people. In fact, it was a midget expert chess player hiding inside the machine. So I mean, this was 150 years ago or more, so it was actually a scam. But when Amazon created this service, it allows, it's not bidding for projects, it's bidding for bit work. And people can choose to do bit, like piece work, down to tiny, tiny, tiny pieces and build for a few cents each. A typical example is that a large website that has user forums and so on, and allows people to upload photographs, might just need to make sure that the photographs meet their community guidelines, so no nudity or, you know, whatever it might be. How long does it take someone to do that? A couple of seconds, you look at the photograph, that's okay. Yeah, that one's okay. And that you might have 50,000 of these coming in a day, so you just put it up as a job on Amazon's Mechanical Turk and say, right, we'll pay 1 cent per photograph you look at. That's happening now. Interestingly, the estimates are that 40% of the work currently being done via Mechanical Turk is to support spammers and other grey activities, such as writing a comment on your blog that links back to or whatever. And again, this kind of work is picked up by people. You can read that English is not necessarily their first language. But you've got people working on jobs at Mechanical Turk, say from refugee camps in Africa. They can get a computer with internet access for an hour a day, so they'll earn a dollar or two by knocking off some quick work there. On the automation side, we have stuff starting to come together for video, film and video and image processing. I mean, finding the face and face recognition, I mean, that's just now built into Facebook and Google Plus and all the other services. So once a face has been recognised somewhere, they can name all of the people in a photograph. That's happening today. Cameras do the whole, is there a person in here? We'll only take the photograph when their eyes are open and they're smiling. We won't take the photograph when they blink. We'll... You know, that's in $200 cameras in your pocket today, in my pocket. We're not far from having automated basic hack work video editing, where we're finding where is the movement, where do we pick the scene, where are the people, how do we trim that down, looking at the words in a script, what's the narrative structure. Okay, we're not exactly going to get Reservoir Dogs out of that process, but what you are going to get out of it is, I don't know, perhaps to use the sport example again, what happens to sporting coverage when everyone's got a camera phone in their pocket that can shoot high definition video and stream it in real time. Every parent of every kid's sporting match is going to be there proudly shooting video. Well, what if all that's going up to some sort of service that says, let's stream that out as a live service, but let's just pick the best shot. You know, is the ball in flight? Who's got a good wide shot? We'll go to that camera. Who's etc. etc. That stuff's being played with now. It's not very far away. So I guess over all of that, the messages are automation, globalization, the repetitive stuff is becoming cheap to the point of or completely automated. People are happy quite often with average quality. And again, the only thing, say, to use the cabinet maker example for furniture, when the only possibility was to have it made by a craftsman, everyone had craftsman-made stuff, and they didn't think about the quality. And I think, for example, in television production, everyone is used to the massive high production values of the ABC and SBS and commercial television, because it used to be that all that stuff was so expensive to get hold of and so hard to use that you only ever had trained professionals involved. And it wasn't because that's what the audience demanded, that was just simply how it came out of the wash in that case. And I think that's shown now that people are spending, you know, it's gradual changes, but kids are spending less time watching television than everyone of our age, broadly speaking, in the room. Okay, there's a bit of a spread here, but But you know, kids younger than us are watching less television, watching more of their own stuff, or of random strangers that they find online. And I think that trend is going to continue. And I think that trend is an example of a trend that is happening across every endeavour that involves, quote, creativity, unquote. I might leave it there at that point and throw it open to discussion.
Well, One area that I think we're seeing this happen is in advertising and marketing. Mm-hmm. And there's a movement away from traditional advertising, which is based on interrupting someone who's doing something they're interested in, like watching TV, to creating something that people are interested in. So creating a piece of content online that, you know, for a website, say, or a blog, or social media, that is going to attract attention, get people sharing it, and create awareness for your brand or your product. Mm. So I can see a real movement. Firstly, corporations, but also businesses, large and small, need to create this content that people are going to be interested in. And right now, it's freelancers largely, or employees of companies who are doing this, or agencies, whoever it might be. But I can see a huge potential for that to move offshore to, like you were saying, whether it's India or it's Africa or...
Absolutely.
And that's...
When you've got a half a megabit fibre link from your home, I mean, you want this 2 hours of video footage to be checked, you know, the voice transcribe, or the voice transcription, you do the first cut automatically, and then you just have a tertiary educated person, good secondary education person in any English-speaking nation to just cross-check the computer transcription. And yes, absolutely, and then or cut the video down, and then it comes back. There are services that are already doing this. I saw one advertised the other day, that for many businesses, like a classic graphic design or graphic production job, is the deep etching, the getting rid of the background so you've just got, you know, the the people in the business their mugshot against a transparent background. Well, there's someone who's doing that as a service. They actually have someone here in Australia to kind of take the orders and do all that, but they're just shunting the files off and bring them back cleaned up, and it's incredibly cheap. Now, whether that represents an opportunity for, oh, hey, hang on, I can get all the grunt work done out there, I'll mark it up from $5 an hour to $50 an hour, and I can still undercut the design agencies who want to charge $150 an hour, and everyone wins. It's because they're getting they're getting the to five an hour, and previously they'd be getting it $5 a week. You know, everyone's winning in the whole equation. Until you get the whole part of business is market up and sell it on. You know, I think the spice routes and the Silk Road were all about this stuff over here in China and India that Europe wanted, and it's the expense of shipping it around. Well, with information, the cost of shipping information anywhere is trending to zero. So eventually the people at the end go, hang on, there's a person who was willing to pay $150 an hour, and I was, hang on, why don't we just talk direct? Who needs the person in the middle to broker that?
I'd be interested in finding out who here sees themselves in a role, in a job, or, you know, what they do for a living, having that potentially being outsourced either to someone in India or a computer. Show of hands, who's in that sort of position?
You mean our work would be?
Yeah.
I constantly, every single day, I get Indians asking me to outsource work.
Ooh, me too.
Looking for work, yep.
Every time. Yep. And then I also find that you haven't brought up the discussion what happens to creative people who, even the talk of the minimum wage was this week. Yes. We're getting to the point where Australians, even freelancing, are not going to make the minimum wage if they keep in this position that everything's outsourced, and I'd like someone to discuss that.
I don't have an answer. One thing I'll throw in, there's the issue of there are two reasons why we are more expensive than other places in the world. One is we have, during the last 200 years of Western society, built up stuff like education systems, healthcare systems, transport systems, sewers, insurance, non-corrupt governments, he says. Ish, you know, on the scale, justice systems and so on. All of that costs money, which we pay for through the about taxes, the economy, etc., etc. If you're getting someone in a malaria-ridden village on Zanzibar to do that, then you're really kind of ignoring the corporate social responsibility stuff that we all try and pretend we're into. The second fact is, we all want all this fancy technology and lifestyle to continue forever. And we're the richest and most spoiled people on the planet in this country, by and large. Or amongst them, we're certainly in the top 10. You know, there was the OECD thing last week where it's on so many scales, Australia tops the world of everything from healthcare to education to sort of happiness more broadly. And we want the latest gadgets now. I don't know. I think that is an interesting thing to throw into the equation as well, because, you know, I'm probably not the oldest person in the room, but I do certainly still remember, which was when you wanted something, you saved for it, and you went without until you got it. And that doesn't seem to happen now. So
does in my house.
Good to hear. Actually, I should say though that when those figures come out, that the Australians have gone, hang on, we have put too much on credit, we are pulling back, and that's one of the reasons Harvey Norman is and sort of having trouble with the other big department stores. People have cut down on their big household item spending.
So, how do freelancers here differentiate themselves from cheap freelancers overseas? How do we add value to our service to make us the better choice?
That's the question. That is absolutely the question. Now, in some cases, it'll be local knowledge. There's a great example of this. I wish I could remember the name of the paper now. It's a Californian local daily newspaper. I forget which town. They actually have all of their local government news written in India. It just so happens that the local government in the county or whatever in this city is in, they live stream all of their council meetings, you know, through the council website. All of the documents and paperwork are online. All of the planning applications are there. Anyone on the planet can just access this stuff and write a story about it. And it works very, very well until there's some local nickname or jargon for a place that they miss. And I must look this up for the next time I talk about this, because there have been some absolute howlers where they've completely missed the point of what was going on because they took the general meaning of the word for something instead of the local knowledge of that town. I think that's one differentiator that's absolutely local knowledge. But, you know, increasingly that's going to be find-outable. And what businesses, you know, what stuff does depend on local knowledge and what doesn't. There is also the fact that people like dealing with people. Business is a social activity. And, you know, I don't know about you, but I certainly do business with people I like doing business with and tend to go back to them to try and sell them more work than to people who are less nice.
We have to sell that social side and that communication side, because I work for a publishing company who has outsourced a lot of their web development to India.
Mm.
And we constantly come up against problems, and it takes so long to iron them out.
What sort of problems
are
you
getting? They keep going back.
Do you know what the problems are? Or?
Oh, just like little glitches. and you know, you only have an hour or so in the day to communicate with your team in India. But the cost saving is so incredible that they're willing to
put up with it.
Encounter these delays and problems and stuff over months and months and months just to get a bare bones website.
That's awesome. Get frustrated?
In some cases, yes, but I think the impact is not as financially viable as it would be if you fork out $250,000 for a massive, amazing website. So they're willing to take that risk. And so it just baffles me in how freelancers
are. Yeah, I mean that's the price differential. I still have from when I was doing some network management and other things, and we used to do web development for people. I mean, I haven't for years, except for one client I just kept on because they were really nice people. And so I think, hey, I'll keep coordinating all your stuff. And we had it down to a system. There was a developer I was working with, and I thought, you know, it was all just a no-brainer, and it chugged along. But I still have a shared internet hosting server. So I've got a server sitting in a rack in San Francisco somewhere, and I actually have the first level of support and other things handled by a team in India who they do the whole just check that it's not something obvious before they contact me. So I pick it up from second level support up and do it. So the customers are kind of still getting, they can get my personal service when I need it. And I think that's the thing, because I know their business and, you know, I've done so for years and can translate it from Australian business language, I know your business, to English as second language, but highly skilled network administrators in Mumbai, but you missed the point. So I can translate into the technical terms. As soon as I translate it into pure geek speak, oh yeah, fine, you know, it's global geek language. They've recently put up their hourly rate for ad hoc systems administration work to $30 an hour. Matt, what's the current rate if you want to try and get a good network admin?
What, here?
Yeah.
A lot more than that.
Yeah. I mean, my charge out rates when I was doing it, I haven't really put my rates up for a couple of years, was 160 an hour.
That sounds about right.
Yeah. Well, yes, actually, because I there was a guy the other day when I ended up having to deal with was Chergwin for the inherited Drupal site got very hacked, and a Drupal security guy, he said, well, normally I would charge $300 an hour for, you know, no notice. You know, you want me to go in and do what now? Yeah, $300 an hour. That's specialised knowledge of it, yeah. So I'd normally expect to pay $200. So again, that's the price differential you're looking at. And this, you know, this crew in India, they're not a business with tiny margins. They're doing quite nicely, thank you, by charging $30 an hour for sysadmin work.
For anyone looking in on this conversation right now, it'd be a wonder that all of us just don't want to crawl out of here and, you know, total depressed and not do a thing. Because in the creative industry, you've told to aspire to something. I've told so many young people, try and do this, do things the right way, and the rest of it. They've got nothing to look forward to because it's all being outsourced to India. And it is quite depressing. I'm finding it hard to even encourage people to go into a creative field at the moment.
I think the key...
that personal relationship with you as a creative.
Yeah, but you need to build that up over time, which, for example, I have, having been in it a long time. But when you're looking at people upcoming, you know, and they're having to compete on freelance.com for next to nothing, they don't even earn enough to buy legal software. I mean, it's ridiculous. How can you possibly compete against that? I mean, I do everything down the line and upgrade everything every year down the line the proper way. But my expenses are such that there's no way I could compete with anyone from India. And I think that's unrealistic.
But have you heard of anyone actually going to any of those sites, like freelancer.com for logo design or whatever?
Yes, loads of them.
Yep.
And they just want it.
I mean, those are growing. I mean, 99 Designs is the other one, and this crosses over. And freelancer.com, I'm fine with. They're creating a global marketplace, and it's fair. But 99 Designs takes it.
It's not a global marketplace. I mean, it's very much geared towards making use of the skills that exist in India and Pakistan.
Correct.
Yeah,
correct. And Matt Barry, the CEO, will try and spin it and say, oh no, we've got people in Australia working for Australians or whatever, and I go, yeah, and what proportion out of your...
I was at this thing a couple of days ago, and he said, it's our aim to get everybody in India, Pakistan to pay $5 a month. And he said that. That's his business model. That's his business target. So, I mean, it's absolutely outsourcing in one direction.
Yep. And that is it. I think that's going to be a great global leveler of pricing. The pricing differential and the income differential and all of those differentials between rich Western nations and those that are not is that essentially we've kind of outsourced poverty or outsourced the working class or like peasantry or something. I need to work on a better soundbite for that. But but really what's happening is, you know, during the industrial age, in our big industrial cities, we had the middle classes sort of sitting there, and we had the rulers there, and then there were all these awful factory workers and peasants who did things. So we don't get to see them anymore. That's the rest of the world does that stuff, and we just sit in comfort and buy this up. So I'm going even more bleak than you thought here, because
I'm trying to find something that we can hold on to bring all the creatives forward, because unless we do, there'll be nothing left.
I think the key to whether something can be outsourced is whether something can become a commodity.
Mm. Yep.
And that's sort of the really key defining thing. Like, can you take a bit of work and package it up and describe it so it's completely its own thing and send it off for someone to do? And the thing is, we all know that a lot of work can't be commoditized like that.
Mm.
And we fool ourselves that it can. Things, you know, any kind of design task, any kind of problem solving, it's very, very hard to kind of wrap up and send off to someone that doesn't understand the problem, right? Like, even creating a website for someone, I think, is a design problem, right? You're trying... A good person going into that goes, you know, what's your business? Tries to understand it, tries to understand...
But the general public don't want to know that.
Exactly. But I mean, I guess what I'm saying is that I think in the short term, there's like this kind of crazy rush to commoditize everything, to try to find ways of wrapping all these little bits up. But in the long term, things are going to swing back the other way, and people are going to go, well, actually, you know, there it is worth investing in aspects of it. But then there's still going to be this vast market of, you know, if you want someone to mock up a few different versions of how a web page might look, you could send it off on this marketplace. But the big problem solving, I mean, that's where that, if as a freelancer, if you don't want to be outsourced, that's where you should be looking, right? That's where you should be focusing. And I think it's about just remembering all the stuff that can't be commoditized and
One of the first things outsourced was computer programming. But they didn't send the designers and the analyst people. They all still lived in the United States. The people in India were given a set of specifications and told, write a program that does that.
Right, and it
they didn't do any design work, but they were doing the spade work.
Yeah. And it doesn't work in practice.
In terms of software, that was always Microsoft structure. And I always thought that the really best software in the world was written by focused teams of a few people working intently together, and you'd get this lean and new and wonderful software. Microsoft, on the other hand, had, you know, cubicle farms full of first-year-out graduates who'd receive an email saying, right, dialogue box number 265 in Microsoft Excel, blah, 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 needs to be do this or whatever. And they'd write a little piece. And then the guy in the next cubicle might be writing some code to do a different dialogue box, and he'd write that. And there was no sense of, hang on, this is almost the same thing, but why do we have two different sets? And that's how you'd get, it's called this in one dialogue, but it's labelled differently here, and the software's now 30 megabytes of code because none of it has been done. And that's what you get with that process.
A few years ago, Microsoft put out a book called Microsoft at Work, which I've got a copy of at home, and it was all about major changes in the computer industry being done by very, very small teams of people. Like the one guy who wrote Pac-Man. One man. Yeah. The 7-8 people, it wasn't designed the first Apple Macintosh.
Yep.
That wasn't the industrial design of the box. That was the people who wrote the software, but the hardware.
I know. We're going off this. So I suppose, I mean, you're right, Matt.
They're connected in a sense because they're small groups of people that are solving big problems together and doing all the bits and pieces. Whereas if you compartmentalize and try to overstructure problem solving, you end up kind of going around in these crazy big loops, which is, I guess, that Microsoft way. And I guess the other part of the sort of the existence of those outsourcing sites is that part of them is convincing everybody that that's the right way to do things, right? And it's going to take a while for people to realize that it's not right to do that always, because
actually I will throw a point in on this. That's absolutely it. You get the buzzword merchants talking about these are the trends, and the trends are crowdsourcing, which is worse than outsourcing. Crowdsourcing is essentially expecting the rest of the world to do your shit for free. And that's 99 Designs it's a Melbourne company, become global. I mean, their whole thing is you put up, oh, I need this design, a business identity, logos, brochure, whatever, and you put the work up, say, this is what I want. And people do work on spec, and you just pick the one you want and pay just the one you want, and everyone else gets nothing.
Intellectual property.
Well, yeah, I mean, the intellectual property is a term which, well, I won't start that discussion. the term needs work, and there's a billion challenges there, and that's a whole thing for another time. But yeah, the whole thing about doing work on spec, I find really poor. But the problem is, at the moment, there are people who want to break into a field and who are willing to do that.
But I mean, the sad thing about the design thing, right, is I agree with you. Like, the design on spec thing is bad, and every designer worth their salt will hate the design on spec thing. But the reality of the situation is, the entire design industry, any kind of creative industry, is always like exploit the labor of keen people who are desperate to,
yeah, they're
to
called break. Interns.
Exactly. The only difference is now they're making money rather than working for free for the advertising agency or whatever, on spec. So it's just shifted the balance. And the real power players, who are the agencies, the intermediaries are the ones that are losing out in this crowdsourcing.
And that and that's interesting because I mean the whole structure of how the internet is changing the world. The buzzword there is disintermediation. It's as I said before, it's like you don't when everybody is connected to everyone else and you know, you don't need people in the middle to communicate for you.
So what you're talking about, it's the consumer taking the power to get what they want any way they want it, and the internet has made that possible for them. So disregarding taste or whatever, they can go to freelancer.com and buy their terrible logo for $5.
And if that's all they want, that's what they got.
Yeah, it might be a good one. Might be a good
and they've got it for $5, and that's the problem. It's because most... I mean, who works in design? Anyone design that? Yes, a few. So... Oh, what's the kind of taste level of the average small business owner? You know what it is. Come on, let's be real. They have no idea, and you are forever explaining them to them why their ideas are crap.
Well, it's like desktop publishing, you know.
Ah, so I went through that one.
It was the conversation about desktop publishing,
wasn't it?
As opposed to designers, and I mean,
everyone's a magazine editor in desktop publishing.
And
yeah.
At some point, you have to differentiate yourself, and you have to say, "Well, you know, there's some strategic problem solving that needs to be required here," and you know, you have to work harder to find those clients and keep them. And they act that you know that's the benefit in the long run. So that's.
Yeah, I think it is. It's and I like it because you've got a whole lean forward approach. It is, damn it, this is a challenge. Let's just grab this. But we also now have a global communication system which we can use to find clients.
Yeah, exactly.
Who like our stuff.
On the flip side, yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know,
and I can now sell into Estonia or Alaska or China or anywhere. And indeed on that, I was talking about recently to, and this is perhaps somewhere where Australians in particular have an advantage. I was talking to a Singaporean guy who is a television commercial producer, yeah, makes TV ads, and he comes to Australia, he comes to Sydney to get his TV ads made, and I thought, hang on, you can do this like way cheaper in Singapore, what are you talking about? And he said, yes, I can put the spec out, we'll you know, storyboard it and whatever. And the ad will come back, and it's perfect. It's beautifully lit. It's magnificently edited. Everything's sharp and crisp, and it is boring as batshit. And he said, if I come to Australia, I'll get something that's probably not quite what I expected to get, but that's the whole point. It's surprising, and it will...
Yeah.
I'll get that, because he said, because Australians just break rules, ignore rules, and that's something that can be solved.
I think that surprise, that element of surprise, is something... that I think is really important to nurture clients, because they come to you with a set of, you know, predetermined kind of ideas on how they want it to look, and then if you go back to them with that element of surprise and, you know, think you can show that you've really thought about what their business does and who they are and how they need to communicate that, then that element of surprise is a really, really important thing.
No, I think you're right, and I'll throw it again. I've thought of another example that shows that it's the Australian characteristic. There was actually a US Army general from CENTCOM, and he ended up working with some Australians in the Iraq War recently, and he said, the thing about the Australian soldiers, you can even have a copy of their orders and you still don't know what they're going to do. He said, let alone the enemy knowing what they're going to be doing. He says, I don't even know what they're going to do. And that I think, was the essence of it.
Ninjas.
Pretty much.
That's true. Curious.
And if you'll get one other point that you brought up, how do you encourage the young people into the future, you know, explain to them how to earn a living when they see all these things happening. I know a lot of my students have become, you know, they do at times become very despondent when I say these things. I think the bottom line is, you know, creating something that is remarkable, something that is outside of the square, something that someone else hasn't done before, and then actually getting that particular whatever it is and then really exploiting it to its maximum. And I think
I mean, a friend of mine in England, he lives in Manchester. His company, he doesn't have any clients in the UK at all. He did originally, but now none. Most of his clients are in America, and a couple or two here in Australia. But and he is able to, with Skype and FaceTime and some of the other programs that he's able to use, communicates with them all. But his program that he's come up with is quite remarkable in itself. And that's really what he's got off on. The other area too that hasn't come up in discussion that we should be aware of in this is in Rangoon at the present moment. The Burmese, the Burmese government were very funny about the internet for a long time, as the Chinese were.
Mm.
But students coming out of now of the American school in Rangoon are very, very computer literate, and they all speak English. Beautiful English, in fact. And they're coming up with some really remarkable work. So that's coming onto the market as well.
Yeah.
And as Burma opens up, that's going to be a market that we're going to have to be also aware of too.
Yeah, I think the our ideas and experience of non-Western nations having just the English communication problem, that's going to go away.
Mm.
That's going to go away as all these kids grow up watching The Wire just like anyone here.
Mm.
Well, God, if they speak like that. Anyway. wrong example program. Perhaps not The Wire. The West Wing. Yeah. No.
Should we be looking, though, with young people that we're training up to have to encourage them to think in terms of being innovative and working beyond being process workers? I mean, maybe we're looking at it the wrong way. Maybe we should be thinking, well, it's okay to send the process work out. What we should be doing is using our brains and opportunities. Yeah. I mean, if you think, how old's the iPhone? 6 years? 7 years?
No, no, we're near.
5 years? Yeah. Okay, so 4. So 6 years ago,
yeah. See, look at that. Look at that perception. Look at that. That's amazing, isn't it?
So, yeah, I think I was probably out of touch. That was all. 6 years ago, there's no such thing as an app developer.
Yeah.
Now they're everywhere. So,
they were called a different thing.
Well, probably, it's a programmer, but it's a different type of programmer. Maybe it's a case of we need to think, well, it's okay to farm out the process part of it if they're happy to do it.
Look, I think you're right, and there's plenty of role models we can point to for that. I mean, the startup scene.
Decades.
Okay, there's a weird thing. I'm going to say this startup scene. I think of the Silicon Valley model, and I'm pausing because about a billion thoughts came to mind, and I just saw the time. But there is this sense in the computer related world to try and ape Silicon Valley, when in fact Silicon Valley happened from a unique intersection of American defense contractors with massive amounts of money and the Californian counterculture kind of colliding in this. You know, that's not able to be repeated anywhere. But there are some amazing creative things happening. And just on the weekend, and I haven't caught up with the full details event, there was an event called GovHack. This year. Have you seen any of the stuff out of that yet, Peter? GovHack. Hacking government data, by hacking in the sense of the good sense of hacking, the whole, you know, doing innovative things and pushing the boundaries of computing. But the Australian government has a process by which they're slowly getting lots of interesting government data sets and putting them online in a way that anyone can access. And on the other side, well, they brought together for the weekend, and these hack camps happen over the course of a weekend. People gather on Friday night for drinks, and then they're presented, and the government people say, okay, here's all of the new sets of data that you might like to play with. And then teams get together and look at that and think, well, what might we do with that? And then by Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock, they have to have a working application, or at least as best they can. They've done something with this data to have fun with, and then they're judged on that, and they might get prizes, or they might get a $20,000 government grant to develop it further. to really kind of push the boundaries. And I haven't had a chance to see what was online yet for any of those this time around. No, I was busy doing other things. But again, there's teams of people who are coming together to do innovative stuff.
I was just disappointed. I was going to go to bar camp in Canberra, and the guy running GovHack was going to be there giving a talk, and I couldn't get there. So.
But the one of the interesting things that happened, I did see one line blip up in front of me last night, where it was a quote from one of the government guys. Like, even the department, even the deep geeks in this government department who created this data went, sorry, you could create what and figure out what from what we had? How did you do that?
Mm. So, it's yeah. Keep on
yeah, it is.
We're going to have to start wrapping up, but I'd like to just do one more kind of round of addressing that question of the big question is, what can we do as freelancers or for our, you know, for young up and coming designers, for example, to really ensure that we've got not just a living, but, you know, that we can actually thrive and we can actually, you know, make something of ourselves in the world. The main area I work in is search engine optimization. It's, you know, one of the biggest outsourced roles, and pretty much everyone here that runs a business probably gets emails and phone calls on a weekly, if not daily basis, from Indian companies in particular offering their services. But I've picked up a few big clients recently who have been with either Australian or outsourced agencies, and they haven't been happy. And you said two words earlier, personal service. They're getting a service, but they're kind of getting a cookie cutter approach.
And in some cases in that industry, a semi-criminal approach.
Well, yeah, absolutely. They can drive them.
That's not even another.
What they're basically said to me is that no one's taken the time to actually understand them and understand their business, build a personal relationship, but you know, get to know their business. And it goes back. Has anyone read the book Lynchpin? Seth Godin. He's written this book. I recommend that you read it. It's fantastic. Yep. It's about becoming indispensable. and
how many of you are familiar with Seth Godin?
It's a fantastic book, and one a good one for up and coming, you know, graphic designers or anyone who's entering this field. And it's basically it's being remarkable. It's being passionate about what you do and treating it as an art. And the way I see that is getting, and for me personally, it's really getting to know my clients and getting to know their business and their challenges and coming to them with ideas and saying, hey, how about we do this? And, you know, it's something new. And that's what freelancers do. They're doing it because they're passionate about what they do. And I think that really is the crux of it, that it's one thing to outsource to a process overseas, which really, you know, I kind of see it as a factory, you know, a production line type of approach. Sure, there's passionate people on freelancer.com too, but no one but yourselves can understand your clients in the way you can. I think it kind of, for me, it boils down to that. And it's... So I recommend that book, Lynchpin.
Here's another one too, which is really, really good, apart from The Purple Cow, which he's probably most famous for, but he's written another book called Small is Big, and really it's very relevant to a lot of the things we've been talking about tonight. So he's quite an extraordinary man, Seth Godin, his books are very cheap, they're not expensive, but I recommend them to all of my students, and in fact they all get off on them. Books and writings, they're wonderful.
Sounds like we have to, I don't know, create some kind of campaign that educates businesses about our cause and our value. Because it sounds like businesses make the mistake or use these services once, they have a bad experience, and then they come back
to local suppliers. So it's like that experience needs to get out in the media more often, and perhaps freelancers are the one that need to be behind that.
Well, maybe you should find the worst company there is and go and pimp them, and then they'll have the bad experience and come back.
Oh, I like that stealthy approach.
One of the basic things that I find in business is that there seems to be sometimes a lack of respect to the business model itself. Returning phone calls, writing a letter. I mean, still to this very day, if you get a well-worded letter that's written to you, a letter where that actually has a stamp on it, you will open that. Whereas an email's, I mean, I had a response to an email only last week. That I wrote that email of the last week in February, and this person said, sorry, I'm just getting around to it now. That would never happen with a letter. But emails and things, I mean, I go away for 2 or 3 days, come back like the other day. There was 142 emails. I said, this is ridiculous. I'm going nuts with emails. But the thing is, there seems to be in business generally a lack of respect of business principles and the way that we actually do business. And just common courtesies.
I think that's because a lot of people think that they can be fly-by-nights and set up for $5 a logo, $100 for the rest of the business, and they don't care about anything else. They're just trying to make the money that they can do. And so they don't understand business principles.
That's always been the case,
I think.
Yeah, I know, but even more so now.
Contact is really what it's giving that personal service that sort of outsourcing can't do. I mean, yes, you can do it up to a point, but to be able to discuss with your client and sit down and develop something, it takes a long time to do that, and you can't do it with emails and phone calls and Skype and all the rest of it. It's just that one-on-one, and I find that the clients that I have, apart from my teaching, but my clients, most of them, in fact, almost all of them, are very long-term ones, and other people have approached them to get to take the business away from it, and they say, oh no, and if you analyse it, the reason why is because I keep in contact with them all the time. I ring them up. I send them birthday cards. I do all sorts of things.
So you're nice.
I'm just nice to them, my bank account reflects how nice one can be.
Being nice to clients.
The clients are something which just comes, and in a small business environment like what we're in here. We can, in fact, really benefit by this closeness of our environment here. This cluster that we've got is a very valuable one. And by outsourcing, we destroy that cluster.
Yeah.
We fragment it to the point where it means nothing. And if I get a client or someone comes to me and wants me to do something, I say, I'm sorry, but that's just not the way I do business. And they can't understand that, but they think, well, you're looking at gift horses in the mouth. No, I'm not.
you can recognise a disaster when you see it coming.
It's written all over it, disaster with a capital D. I just think it's just basic business principles and doing business properly, communicating correctly, using all the modern technologies that are out at our disposal. I mean, this, my iPad, I love this, and I love my iPhone. I mean, I would be lost without them, but I use them sensibly, and I think a lot of people are using them, being quite stupid. And I think, you mentioned before about, television, young people not watching television. We just did a survey not very long ago with the students, and yes, the actual time spent watching television is almost non-existent now. It's like it's almost finished. And a lot of these reality shows and things which they just say, well, we just don't watch
it.
It's very interesting.
We're going to have to wrap it up in a moment. We've only got until 7 o'clock here, and it'd be good to leave a little bit of time for perhaps another drink and a bit of networking. Did you want to have any closing comments to wrap it all up?
just a couple of sentences. What you just said there about using the technology, I will absolutely support. There's lots and lots of wonderful tools out there. Just find out what is appropriate for your industry, you know, where people are communicating, what new tools are available to you, what new services are packaged up and available to you as kind of automated things that might help you. And secondly, gentlemen at the back there, you mentioned ninjas before. Absolutely. As freelance, well, I go back to the army. The bulk of the army, 90% of the army, are the foot soldiers. Freelancers are not the foot soldiers. Freelancers, I hate the word ninjas, but the snipers, shall we say. The special forces. Ninjas is overworked. Sorry, just as a side, when people say they're looking for a rock star developer, I want to put a... What, you want an egomaniac who doesn't, like, know what you're doing yet? No, no, no. But you know, it's the flexibility, it's the ability to focus down on a specific task, a specific niche, to develop your own style. Those are the advantages, and you know, there are changes in the world. Stay abreast of them, but you know, if you're surviving in freelancing at all, you already probably have the skills you need to continue surviving. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.